Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me here is the great Armin Navabi. He's a great advocate for the Hindutva movement. They're all rallying behind him. They absolutely love him right now. Armin, how are you? How are you holding up?
I'm good. I just got an email from Twitter telling me that... Oh, the second one. Two emails saying that the law enforcement, Indian law enforcement, has filed a legal complaint against my tweets, and Twitter is emailing me, not telling me that they're not going to take it down. So it's very interesting because I usually get these emails from Pakistan. Uh-huh. This is the first time I'm getting an email like this from India, which shows how India is becoming more and more like Pakistan. But now they get. Yeah, so every time I get an email with the subject, like this from Twitter legal or whatever, I'm like, oh, Pakistan, what are you up to, Pakistan? But today it's from India, so congratulations, India, your Pakistanization is getting there. Yeah, you're getting there.
Yeah, all of this shit has to change. It's just so, but I'm really glad that you've exposed that. It's amazing. I actually never thought it would be at the scale that it is right now. For those who don't know, you can listen to our one of our previous episodes that we did on the Hindutva provocation that Armin did and the response that it got, which is very similar to the kind of response you get usually from Islamic fundamentalist jihadist type people, right? So it's pretty nuts. But today we're going to talk about something else in a different part of the world that's long been a nexus of conflict. So the Trump administration has brokered peace agreements between Israel, the UAE, and Bahrain. And this is largely to the credit of Jared Kushner, who's Trump's son-in-law. The deal has been praised by many conservatives and by liberals around the world, but there are several important questions that remain, and we are going to talk about them. What does a quote-unquote peace deal look like between two nations or three nations who aren't really at war? How does Iran play into this? I mean, this seems to be like the enemy that Israel and those Arab states have in common and have a strategic imperative to compete with. And finally, where are the Palestinians in this? Like, what happened to the Palestinians? So we're going to talk about all of this stuff dive under the surface.
Interesting, because look at the title of this video, right? The title of this video, of this podcast is right today is... This episode is the real story behind Israel, UAE, Bahrain peace deal. Okay, so the main countries involved are Israel, UAE, Bahrain, and United States. But even though all of these four countries are always mentioned, this deal is mostly about the country that is not being mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. All of these deals are mostly about Iran, even though Iran is not being mentioned. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so it's interesting. And there's another big country here that isn't really officially in the picture yet, and it's Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
So Saudi Arabia and Iran have always had a proxy war. Saudi Arabia, as you know, in addition to these peace deals, Saudi Arabia actually allowed Al Al Airlines, Israeli Airlines, to start flying planes over its airspace, which is a big, big thing. And there are conversations happening with the Saudis. Jared Kushner is actually very close friends with MBS. They actually hang out personally. They're both young people in their 30s who are in very powerful positions in their countries. There's a lot here. There's a lot here to unpack, especially the new alliances. There's like sort of new axes being built.
Here's the thing, though. Basically, if Saudi Arabia, I mean, people already know that Saudi Arabia and Israel are like talking and working with each other behind the scene, but like the consequences and the messaging and the symbolism of Saudi Arabia and Israel ever officially making a peace deal with each other is huge.
That's going to be like massive.
It's massive. And I think, I mean, everybody, this whole, all of this is just basically trying to prepare for that, because they know that the Islamic world and the Arab world cannot just even, you know, it's not ready for that. They cannot even comprehend that happening. I mean, think about all the historical consequences of Egypt, so, you know, making the deal with Israel, and all of the, you know, the assassination, the betrayal, the political backlash to that, the theological Islamic backlash to that, all the movements that was born from that. Okay, and that was Egypt. Now we're talking about Saudi fucking Arabia, right? The land where the two most important symbols of Islam exist. You know, the two holy cities, the birthplace of Muhammad. I mean, if they make a peace deal with Israel, I don't know. I can't even predict what the political and the Islam, you know, the movements is going to just be born out of that, the reaction to that. And I think, you know, Saudi Arabia recognizes that. That's why they need to be like, okay, let's do UAE first, and let's get the backlash from that, and then maybe then do Bahrain. And I think maybe Oman is going to be next. I don't know, right? Mm-hmm. Is it Oman going to be next?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think a lot of the strategy behind this is it's really interesting. So the UAE is the most sort of internationalized, what do you say, internationalized, like economic. It's one of the biggest economic powerhouses. It's sort of in the Arab world, there aren't a lot of countries that are, you know, economically and diplomatically tied to the rest of the world the way that the UAE is. So it's very powerful that way, technologically. If you go there, it looks like you walked into the future. It is so advanced technologically and economically, a tourist destination. And then you have Israel, which is also in the region, not an Arab state, but also one of the most advanced regions in the country. So their alliance is this huge economic powerhouse. It's a powerhouse access, like in terms of the just economic strength. On the other hand, the strategy that Iran has always had is this sort of resistance strategy. They're going to resist everybody. And they've got proxies in Lebanon. They got proxies in Syria, in Gaza. You know, they've got pretty much all over the place. And that resistance and fighting against the enemy and everything, it's going to be that resistance strategy versus this economic alliance to see what overpowers what. So there's that aspect. That is, I think, a big way to counter Iran, for, you know, to form these alliances. And obviously, if Saudi Arabia gets into it, when Bahrain gets into it, you know, this is they're forming like a 21st century kind of alliance that's based on technology, economics, globalization. Whereas Iran's got the sort of traditional, you know, we're going to fight the great Satan kind of thing, the old school, like fighting the enemy military type thing. And those are the two things that are really going to go up against each other.
Did you see the Grand Cleric in Saudi Arabia trying to prepare people mentally for this?
No.
That was like a lot of people started noticing, like, what the fuck is happening? Right? So the Grand Cleric in Saudi Arabia, like, the guy that usually says, like, oh, you know, makes like anti-Semitic comments and like how to need to be fight. Like, and the problem with some of these clerics, like these grand clerics, is that they don't say, instead of saying like fuck Israel, they are pretty transparent by going after the Jews as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they say, like, we need to, you know, they keep referring to how we need to fight the Jews rather than actually. You know, usually the anti-Semitic people, they try to mask it by saying Zionism or Israel or something like that. These people were like usually like, nope, the Jews, you know, like we are fighting the Jews, right? So the people that usually have that kind of narrative, now they were just a couple of days before all of this happened, they were saying that, you know, Muhammad made peace treaties with the Jews and he was fair to them and he didn't mistreat them. And people are like, what the fuck is happening? Like, this is like, you know, grand, you know, declaring this is not the kind of stuff that the, like, people started noticing a shift in tone that it seems to be coming from the higher ups, telling people to like theologically prepare them for getting closer to the Jews. Like, and people, and because of the clerics and the most important clerics in Saudi Arabia are saying, talking like this, people think like a peace deal is coming, isn't it? Like, why are you guys talking like this? Are you you're preparing people mentally for something that you know is going to have a major backlash. I just wonder, man, if it ever comes, if the Saudi, oh my, I can't even imagine. Like, we know that they're cooperating, but just, I mean, if it does happen, it's going to feel like a dream.
Oh,
like,
it's going to happen.
If it happens, it's going to feel like, is this real? Like, am I dreaming this? Like, no, is this happening with our life? Like, Saudi Arabia and Israel, like, having a peace agreement. So no, but again, I don't know, like, what is going to happen after? Like, it's going to be, like, I don't know. Like, do you have any predictions?
Okay, first of all, you can never, ever make a prediction about the Middle East. No. Never, ever. No. It's like making a prediction about whether Trump's going to lose or win. I mean, this is absolutely no point. Okay. But I actually think that it's going to start looking like a EU type of possible, I don't know, like, this could be the realization of the Arab Spring in a way. So it is a very big thing, but there's a lot of stuff under the surface that made this happen.
This is a very smart move by the Trump administration. We have to give them credit for that.
Well, very smart. This is a kind of interesting thing. It was a good move to do. They were in the right place at the right time. It was a smart move to make. And this is one thing that this guy did that's absolutely right. And, you know, they deserve credit for it.
There's two different conversations, whether it's the right thing to do or the smart thing to do. Like, from Trump's perspective, like, right before the elections, like, given that they didn't get any meaningful deal between Israel and Palestine, this is like a major, like, this is a historic thing that Trump could take to the debates with him and be like, look what I've done. Like, I'm like, nobody has ever managed to push for such major changes when it comes to bringing people together in the Middle East before me. Like, even historically, we have like bringing Egypt and Israel together. Like, it's not as big as significance of being Saudi Arabia and Israel together. Like, this is a major win for the Trump administration. Yeah.
So here's the thing. The thing is that this was actually inevitable. And you have to look at what, you know, you said that we couldn't bring the Palestinians and the Israelis together and they did this. So I, you know, the way that I'm seeing it, and the way actually it's not just me, but I think a lot of people are seeing this, is that the reason that this happened is because they couldn't bring Israel and Palestinians together.
Yep.
Remember that deal that was proposed that Israel will be able to get 30% annexed, 30% of the West Bank, and then 70% of it will stay with the Palestinians? And Netanyahu himself, right, helped draft that deal. And everybody's saying, oh, this is, the Palestinians weren't even involved in this deal. 30. And then he himself rejected the deal of getting at 30% of the thing. So then he said,
but again, that deal and could also have been for it to put out there for it to get rejected, just to show that they're not going to play game
because Israel doesn't have to do it. They don't need it. So what happened is that, you know, as soon as that happens, they can't get the Palestinians and Israelis together. The Trump administration is actually desperate. The Jared Kushner is working on this. They're desperate. They're like, okay, so what do we do? We can't get the Israelis and Palestinians together. So they talk to the UAE. They start talking about this annexation. And the UAE says, if you don't annex, right, this part of the West Bank, then we'll make this peace deal with you. Okay, now that's important because what happened is that what Israel's trading is a
non-annex. I think this is even more significant, though.
Yeah,
and whatever that deal would have.
I'm coming to that. I'm telling you why it's so. What the part of it that I find the most interesting is that what Israel did was it took a non thing. It just basically said, okay, we're not going to steal this land, and they exchanged that okay, we're not going to do this for a deal. Now the UAE ended up. Now in comes the Trump administration. They're like, okay, great. We haven't had a win on the Israel Palestine thing. Well, maybe we can get the Arab Israelis, the other Arab states, to make a deal with them. So the UAE comes and says, okay, listen, you know those F-35 planes we've been wanting to buy for a very long time? So the UAE, the F-35 is the most advanced military airplane in the world. Okay.
Which Netanyahu the UAE doesn't need. Yeah.
Yeah. They've been trying to buy it for years, like I think 10 years or something. And the US would not sell it to them. Netanyahu didn't want the US to sell it to them. Then Trump says, you know what? They could look up the headlines, just Google it, F-35 planes. Trump is like, it's okay. I'll sell them to you. Like he just said, I'll sell them because it's the election's coming up. He's screwed because of the coronavirus. He needed like a really, really big foreign policy story. Right. And then what happens is that
Israel said no.
No, they agreed. The F-35 planes, the U.S.
At first they said no.
No, that's part of the deal. Like there's an understanding. The reason that the UAE and the Palestinian deal, one of the reasons that it came about is because they reached an understanding that the F-35 the plane sale is going to be made.
But, so, okay.
Yeah. No, that's just one aspect. I'm just saying there are a lot.
By the way, James is having an issue with you calling it steal the land part. The part that you say.
Oh, it's stealing the land. It's illegal. It's illegal by definition by international law.
Okay, yeah, but we could have another live stream about that another day, okay?
No. Can I address that since you mentioned it?
No, because then I have to respond to you, and then this is going to turn into...
I'm going to say it in a very simple way, right? Okay. Netanyahu, part of his coalition, it's a parliamentary democracy, so they have to make coalitions with other parties, are these sort of like far-right Jewish settler things that are super religious. They believe that the West Bank was given to them by God, Judea and Samaria, like that it's biblically...
We're getting off topic.
Just really quick thing. Netanyahu needs their support. Okay, so they were saying that whatever, but this was actually designated land that is not Israel's. It's just not by international law. It's just not. So
okay. When I was in Israel, there were many Zionists who were against the settlement. So this is not. But that's a different topic. So I actually want to mention a couple of things. How this was a very strategic move against Iran. And it works, okay? Like, this was a major... This is bad and good for Iran at the same time, okay? So I want to talk about that. I also want to mention about how the fact that Iran was boasting about how they're finally at Israel's borders, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you remember, Iran was doing an empire building, a Shia empire building in the region, and a lot of the highest religious officials in Iran, we're saying, like, you know what Khomeini promised today in Karbala, tomorrow in Jerusalem? That dream is becoming true because Iran's, you know, Shia crescent was becoming, like, we go from Iran, then you have Yemen, you have control over Iraq, you have, you know, close ties with Syria and almost control over Syria. That's what they were claiming. And then Lebanon. So basically, Iran's region that of influence, they said that we're going to make a highway right from Tehran all the way to the borders of Israel for us to be able to send our military and army. Like basically, we're saying, like, look, a mission is almost complete. We are right at your doorstep. So you guys, this is why Israel is panicking, because we are home. We are basically one step behind taking Jerusalem, right? The promise that we have ever made, always made. So now what's happening is, like, the counter narrative is like, bull fucking shit. You're losing control in Iraq. You're losing control in Syria. You're losing control in Lebanon. You're even losing control in Tehran, you motherfuckers, right? Because of the uprising and stuff like that. And not only you're not going to be at our doorstep, every single time you try to create a facility, Israel is going to be coming bobbing the shit out of your facilities in Syria when it comes to, if it's close to our doorstep. And not only you are not at our doorstep, we're showing up at your doorstep, motherfuckers, because we are now close to UAE. We're now close to, we're going to be, we have, you know, deals with Oman. Bahrain, we're going to have deals with Bahrain. And these are, now Israel has ties with your fucking neighbor.
We got Saudi airspace.
So we are at your doorsteps. You're not at our doorstep. So that's what the counter narrative is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But this is very scary. I mean, all of Iran's enemies are now become united, right? And they are politically and economically, but not militarily, powerful, right? So they could, and again, because they're not going to be a full out all scale war, it doesn't really matter that Saudi Arabia sucks at warfare, right? It doesn't matter. I mean, Iran is better at that game than Saudi Arabia, even though Saudi Arabia has way more advanced weaponry and much more military power. They just suck at it so badly, okay? But these are economic powerhouses that are now working with each other, so they could choke Iran much more effectively than they used to, right, if they want to, right? However, Iran is trying to fight back against that by making deals with Russia and China. Like, China and Iran just made a huge economic deal, so that's going to be in Iran's favor for a very long time. If that deal happens, as they say, as China says, it happens, because China has is famous for actually making promises on giant deals that actually never took place. So we don't know if that's going to happen or not, actually, the way they say it will happen. So we'll see about that. But the way that this could work in favor of Iran is when it comes to the Palestinian issue is still a very, very, very important ideological fight among Muslims around the world. So this betrayal by these Arab leaders is going to make Muslims more interested in abandoning all the Arab leaders and look at Iran and maybe Turkey for Muslims who are not betrayed. So they're saying, like, the Arabs are saying, look, you are dear Muslim Arabs, you've been betrayed by your own leaders. This is why you should forget race. It's not about Arab, Persian, or Turkish. It's about Muslim versus non-Muslims. And we Iranian Muslims are your guardians, we're brothers and sisters in faith. We do, you know, it's not about Arab, Persian. We are, you know, we are united. We will protect you, even though you're being betrayed by your own Arab leaders, right? And Iran has been very, very, very effective at selling that narrative. Again, because Iran, when it comes to the Shia empire building, it's very limited with the Shia narratives. It cannot go and create such unity and such to gain allies when it comes to the Sunni world. So when it comes to getting allies to the Sunni world, it uses a Palestinian narrative to build ties and allies, right? And this is, you know, this makes that narrative more effective. And this is why Turkey is trying to get in and compete with Iran on that game. Is like, why is everybody, when it comes to the Palestinian issue, why are Muslims around the world relying on Iran? These motherfuckers are Shia. Like, that's why they are using that whole narrative of like, we are anti-Israel. We are supporting the Palestinians, and we are Sunni motherfuckers. Like, come on. Like, why we are supposed to be the leaders? Like, rely on us, not on Iran, right? But the problem is that Turkey cannot be as aggressively anti-Israel as Iran is, because Turkey has more economic and political ties with the civilized world, with the non-authoritarian civilized world. So you cannot be as aggressively as anti-Israel as Iran is. So they are limited by that. So you want to say a few things before I continue?
Yeah, I think that this is a thing. It's so convoluted. I don't know if you guys have seen that sort of map. I think it's online if you do a search about the relationships in the Middle East. And it just looks like a spider web. I mean, spider webs are at least organized. It's crazy the kind of opportunistic relationships they had. I wanted to read out, kind of what I was saying earlier. This is an article by Thomas Friedman. Who has made this case, I think, the most more articulately than anything, where, you know, you say, okay, well, why did this happen? Was it for the right reasons? And does the Trump administration deserve credit? And the thing is that, yes, of course they do. So this is what he wrote. I'm going to quote it. Quote, "The fact that the normalization of Israel Emirates and Israel Bahrain relations was actually set in motion because of the failure thus far of the Trump administration's Israeli-Palestinian diplomacy does not diminish its significance, even if it adds a dollop of irony to our story." And he says his rule is that in the Middle East, you get big change when the big players do the right things for the wrong reasons. So, you know, one of the reasons that, Armin, I think that this was inevitable is that there are two things that are happening. The world's becoming less dependent on oil, okay? And I'll tell you, I grew up in Saudi Arabia. That's all they have. The only reason that Saudi Arabia is as rich as it is because of oil. There's virtually nothing. If it wasn't for the oil, I don't know what would happen to the country, what kind of expertise that, or thing that they'd have to offer to the world, at least at this point, until they develop it. That's number one. Same goes for all the other Arab sort of oil producing states. The second factor is that a huge percent of the population, 70 to 80%, is under the age of 30. The youth is massive over there, right? So, and the youth is more interconnected. They're globalized. They're not as sort of conservative and old-minded the way that their parents and, you know, their older generations were. And they want to move out and they want economic opportunity. They want employment. They have, like, all of these things are real issues. So eventually they're going to have to reach out. Now, the reform is happening. Economic reforms are happening. Kids are getting more sort of educational opportunities, getting more career opportunities. The Arab states are not that open yet, obviously, with when it comes to political dissent and diversity of thought and, you know, religious dissent and so on. But when it comes to all of the other things, they have it in place. And inevitably, that's going to happen too. So I think that the Saudi-Israel deal is inevitable. I don't think that Iran is going to, with its all of the stuff that, okay, we're going to use the Israel-Palestinian issue as a thing to recruit jihadists in Gaza and jihadists in Lebanon and in Syria and all of their proxies. That model of putting up a fight or going against anybody is just not going to hold. The model right now is of globally being interconnection, economic interconnection between states. And now that the oil is becoming more and more a thing of the past, you have electric cars, you have all this other stuff happening, they have to move in that direction. There's no other way.
But Ali, there's still these countries where the leaders are becoming closer to Israel, the population still is very much anti-Israel, okay?
Sure.
So who's, like, don't you think Iran has an advantage of feeding, like, trying to take advantage of the you know, the gap between the leaders and the people? And Iran is very interested in manipulating and taking advantage of the dissent and the dissatisfaction of people with their leaders, with their Islamic leaders, to come in and use that as a way of to have influence, especially with Bahrain, which is
Shia,
right? So imagine, like, so here's the thing: Bahrain is like a Sunni leadership with the majority Shia population. It's like so perfect for Iran. Like, this is a place where the whole Yazid Hussein situation, you know, like, you have the Yazid leadership with the rebellious Hussein narrative of the people going about against the Sunni authoritarians, like all this, and now the leadership is getting closer to Israel. I mean, this works very well for Iran. Like, don't you think, like, you know, the popular demand that the people in these countries have for a more anti-Israeli stance, doesn't that play very well into the hands of the Iranian regime? Again, by the way, we shouldn't say Iran again. We keep saying Iran. We should say, like, Islamic Republic or the Iranian regime. Every time we say Iran instead of the Iranian regime, I get some people contacting me like, hey, can you not mix us with this fucking government, please? So, like, go on.
That's actually a great segue to the answer to how I'm going to answer your question.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so what happened is Iran, as you talked about, that poll that came out where it showed that only about probably 40,000 people, about 40% of them identify Islam as their religion. So Iran is officially a Muslim minority country now, and we've talked about that in the past, according to this poll at least. This is where it's different. This is where the significance of the youth. The reason I'm saying that these alliances are inevitable is, and the reason I'm saying that that's because of this explosion in the youth and them being interconnected, is because those things are changing. So you're saying that, you know, the UAE, like, the people over there are still largely anti-Israel. We don't know that for sure, but we do know that the trajectory is going against it. In the UAE, right, that this deal is actually popular with more people than people thought. Like, you know, when Egypt made the deal, a lot of Egyptians were pissed off about it. They weren't super, super happy about it. And when Ahmadinejad was in power, I remember he used to say, we're going to wipe Israel off the face of the earth and all this stuff. And he used to say, the Arabs used to listen and say, yes, why can't our leaders say this? The Iranian guy is saying it. That's one thing. The second thing is that there's two levels of rivalry. When you talk about, Bahrain and being a Shia majority population, for sure, a lot of them don't like being ruled by a Sunni dictator, right? But there are two rivalries there. Is this a Sunni-Shia rivalry? But then there's also the Persian and Arab rivalry.
Yes.
And that plays a big part into it. That played a big part in Iran, actually. With the Iran and Iraq situation. So there was a Sunni kind of alliance. I mean, you would have thought that when Iraq became a democratic state and elected a Shia leader and everything with the Shia population, that Iran and Iraq would have had this amazing alliance. And they did form an alliance, but it wasn't the revolutionary, like earth-shattering kind of powerhouse that it could have been. And a lot of that has to do with these disparate groups that are also in the middle of this ethnic rivalry of Persians and Arabs. So it's so complex, and the interplay between people with these different identities, religious identities and ethnic identities, is so complex. It's very, very hard. And even within the religious thing, right? You have Lebanon where you can go to bars and people walk around and, women dress the way they want.
I went and drank alcohol with my secret atheist friends in Palestine in a bar. While the Azan was playing, I never met. My God, that was an interesting experience. Yeah. I was drinking alcohol in a bar in Palestine with closeted atheists who were wearing the hijab while drinking alcohol while the Azan was playing. That was the most surreal experience I ever had. That was so amazing.
Yeah, so you're gonna have that. You go to Tunisia. You'll have a totally different, and that's also an Arab and Muslim majority country. And then you go to Saudi Arabia and UAE, completely different. So even within the religious identities, there are rivalries in terms of, okay, who's a Wahhabi, who's a Salafi, who's Shia, who's Sunni. And then there are ethnic issues, right? Like Palestinians, by the way, right? When I was growing up there, the Arabs hated the Palestinians. The only reason they supported the Palestinians is because the Palestinians were like the N-word of the Middle East. That's how they used to refer to them.
Read this comment by James?
Yeah. So James is saying that Netanyahu has been developing these relationships for something like 15 years. Let's not be fooled and think this is all that overnight.
That's why?
Success. Yes,
it's
yes.
Not, it's absolutely. Not an overnight success. So he's saying, let's not be fooled and think this is all an overnight success. That's why I said, like, we knew that Saudi Arabia and Israel were already, it's very well known, it's an open secret that they were working with each other, for example. And again, we also said multiple times on this show that the only thing that can bring the Arabs and the Jews together is their fear of Iran, right? That's like such a big threat to them that they have to put their differences aside because of that.
Yeah.
By the way, I want to address what you were mentioning with regards to the Arab versus Persian rather than and Shia versus Sunni. The mullahs in Tehran, if they're smart enough, I mean, some of them are smart enough, some of them are not, but to do this. But the strategic play should be to use three different narratives for three different goals, right? When it comes to at home, when it comes to in Iran, if they're smart, they have, and some of them are, like even Khamenei understands this now, they should ease their religious talk. They should shut up about Islam. They should shut up about like using religion as a way to come up with policies internally. And they should focus on nationalism, okay? Mm-hmm. National identity rather than a religious identity.
That's right.
And if you notice Khamenei is understanding that and is using less and less religious talk. And it's talking more and more about Iran rather than Islam, Iran more than Islam. And it even has gone as far as saying some things some things are not about religion. And any Iranian would care about, like Khamenei said this. I could not believe 5 years ago that Khamenei would ever say something like that. He said something like, oh, every Iranian, even if they're not religious, would care about this. Like he's touching on nationalist attitudes rather than religious attitudes. Internally they will focus because more Iranians are moving away from religion and hate religion passionately. That is, but Iranians are still very nationalistic, so that would be the narrative that you play at home. when it comes to the region, right at the Shia Crescent, you know, the Shias there are still extremely religious, and they look at Tehran for leadership, and some of them would even die for Khamenei. Again, I know not all Shias, but a lot of them will. And, you know, in the Shia Crescent, when it comes to Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, you know, Bahrain, using the Shia narrative rather than, you know, and not focusing on Iranian, your Iranian identity, like, oh, no, it's not a bad Iranian. You know, when it comes to people in Iran, you have to be like, yes, we're Iranian. We're better because we're Iranian. But when it comes to people on this kind, like, no, we're all the same. We're all Shias. The Sunnis are evil. Fuck the Sunnis. They're a monarch, like puppet monarchies of the Western imperialism. Let's bring a Shia unity and fight back against them. So that's what you say around the Shias around the region. And that's the narrative that works around them. But then you, once you, so that's a bigger circle. And then once you step one step backwards again, when you look at the Islamic world, then you're like, no, it's not about Shia Sunni, guys. We're all Muslims. Who cares about Shia Sunni? We're all united. We're all Muslim brothers, brothers and sisters. And, well, who cares about the sisters? We're all Muslim brothers. And, you know, fuck. You know, fuck Israel, right? Yeah, fuck Israel. So, like, let's get united against these Zionist agenda around the region. You know, so so these are the three, you know, so small circle, Iran, focus on nationalism. Bigger circle, the Shia Crescent, focus on Shia narrative versus the Sunni narrative. Bigger circle, the Islamic world, focus on your anti-Zionist narrative. So three different narratives for three different audiences. That would be the best strategic play for survival for the mullahs in Tehran.
I completely agree with you. I just think that this is so, it's everything that happened to the right. I can't stress enough the inevitability of this. I mean we all knew that Saudi Arabia and Israel working together for a long time. We knew that they wanted to get together and form this sort of alliance against Iran. We knew that, you know, if it was like the strongest economic countries over there, like Arab countries being Saudi Arabia, Iran, Saudi Arabia and what's the other, the UAE, and then, you know, Israel, and all of them got together and formed this axis, it would be super, super powerful against Iran. But, you know, this also just happened at the right time, right? So it happened at the right time where, you know, Netanyahu is facing a lot of electoral troubles recently.
COVID, because of COVID especially.
Yeah, there's a COVID thing going on. There's like the settlers, Jewish settlers, are, you know, they're pissed off at Netanyahu, so he's trying to, like,
it seems like the Jewish people, Arabs are moving closer to Netanyahu while Jews are moving farther away from Netanyahu, right? Which is very ironic.
No, but especially the fundamentalists, the far right ones, the Jewish settlers, so they're, and then he does this whole 30% annexation of the thing. The liberals in the U.S. are very, very upset with including like the liberal Jews, right? In the U.S., that there's a big chasm right now between the American and the diasporic Jewry, and then the Jews in Israel. So there's all of this stuff happening. And then he says, okay, I'll scale back the annexation. I'm not going to annex anything. I'm just going to leave it that way. And just in time for Trump, like COVID happening, and Trump is looking for a major sort of foreign policy victory, he's obviously vulnerable. He's like, yeah, what do you guys want? He's like, oh, well, I think the F-35 planes, everything comes together. Everything comes together. You end up with this deal. Okay, and now if Trump loses and if Biden becomes the thing, the liberals, the U.S. Democrats are now going to be more willing to reestablish their ties with Netanyahu, because he gave up on the 30% annexation as well. That actually helps him. That helps him get in good with the Democrats as well. So there's so many.
But the reason why people, I think, okay, James, maybe you could correct me, but the reason why now there's Netanyahu is feeling a lot of dissatisfaction in Israel is his handling of the COVID situation. So he's dealing with that. But again, this has been a very good play by both Trump. I mean, both Trump and Netanyahu really need major wins right now to gain support in their countries, right? And whatever problems they're facing when it comes to support from their own country, this does help. This is significant, and this will play in both of their favor. Is it going to be enough? Probably not. I don't know. Maybe not. But again, when it comes to the elections, this what are the chances of this is being something that Trump keeps bragging about right until the election. Well, like, this is going to be a major thing that they're going to keep talking about, right?
Well, when Bob Woodward's book was about to come out, and Bob Woodward had already had this last conversation with Trump and told him that, okay, it's going to be a tough book. Then he called him and he's like, hey, listen, I just got this deal. Can you get this? This is on August 3rd, right, when the deal happened. He's like, can you get that in the book? It's a big deal. You know, I got this deal. And Woodward said, okay. And I think it is mentioned in the book. I don't remember how that turned out. But ultimately, what's happening is that he is trying for a win. Unfortunately, or actually, fortunately for some people, unfortunately, depending on who you're with here, this hasn't really hit the radar of most Americans as much as the whole pandemic.
Yeah, but I know, but Trump is still going to mention it. Like, guys, like, peace in the Middle East. Like, this is a major step in the right direction. Like, honestly, I think it's a good play by him, right? Mm-hmm. Not saying, but you said that this will happen no matter what. I don't think it could have happened the same way if Trump wasn't president, right? Like Trump, like no, if Biden,
it wouldn't happen at this time, at this easily.
Yeah, this easily, and this was the right time. I mean, if Biden wins, you know, this would have been a major missed opportunity for Saudi Arabia and Israel and all the other, like, because Biden is probably going to move closer to Iran. I mean, it's still going to tough talk and be like, oh, this and that, yeah, and Iran has to do this, but they're going to move closer to making better deals, like, close with Iran. So, again, I think last minute, like, they had, like, this, I don't know what kind of, how Israel and Saudi Arabia would have gotten closer to each other, but it would be different. It would be weaker. It wouldn't have United support as much as Trump would have supported it. Like, this, again, doing this right before Trump loses, if he loses, was, like, they couldn't wait and see. Like, this is, like, this was important for them to do it when Trump was still president. And again, the deals would not be so much in their favor if there was another president, if it was a Democratic president.
For several reasons. I mean, that they actually got him at a time when he was desperate. Like, he's looking at an impending loss because of the handling of the thing, and he was willing to do a lot. So they had him in a position where he would have easily given a lot, and he did. He did. Like, so... like the F-35s. So I think 10 years has been saying, okay, I'm not going to sell you the F-35s. And now he's just agreed to them. It's crazy. Susanna, can you highlight Susanna's thing? Let's actually...
where is that?
The one at 10:52. Yeah, so she's saying some of the Palestinians I know are making memes about assaulting Emiratis. So this is what kind of, I think we should talk about this next. That what about the Palestinians? What happens now?
Yeah, they were there. It seems like... The interesting thing is that it seems like they are the least significant part of any of this discussion. And this is what this is why Iran tries to keep highlighting, right? Like, it seems like Iran is being mentioned, United States is being mentioned, maybe the Bahrain. And it's very interesting because when the UAE deal happened, okay, at least what they did was they pretended that this is about the Palestinians, right? So the UAE were like, you know what, guys? We are getting closer to Israel, but because we're closer, now we, like, Israel stopped doing this and that because of this deal. So we helped the Palestinians. Come on, guys. Like, yeah, we did this for the Palestinians. Wink, wink. Like, come on. Like, can you, like, at least there was that, the pretending that this is about the Palestinian there. But the Bahrainian deal, like, they didn't even bother. They're like, yeah, we're getting, like, they didn't even mention they didn't even pretend that this is about Palestinian people.
Yeah,
it wasn't even there. Like, they're like, you're moving past, like, guys, we're making peace deals. We're not gonna let the Palestinians just constantly hold us back. But, like, you know what? We have our own agenda, we have our own interests. Palestinian, Shmalestinian, we don't give a shit. They didn't even pretend, but go on.
Yeah, there's the one thing. So I really think the two-state solution is the right thing to do, but it's just not going to happen now. Like, Israel, it was dead a long time ago. Israel has absolutely no reason to do it. I mean, when Netanyahu rejects his very own plan, allowing him to annex 30% of the West Bank, right, without the Palestinians, and he rejects that own thing because, you know, he thinks he can do better, that means he doesn't need it. It's not going to happen. We're looking potentially at, like, I don't know how this is going to go, but you're looking potentially now at pretty much a permanent undemocratic occupation of, you know, the West Bank and Gaza, right? You're just that's what you're looking at. So there's a couple of things. What would be ideal?
I don't know if the language that you're using is something, well, we could, that would be a different discussion, but go on.
No, well, okay, I'll explain. I'll tell you why I'm using.
No. I don't want this to be an, we could have another live stream talking about, I just want to make sure we focus on this deal.
We're talking about right now. We're going to talk about what's going to happen to the Palestinians in this deal in the future. Okay. Right. So that's what I'm saying, is that right now the Palestinians, I mean, they're living in, so they're going to be living in this occupied territory. They're not going to have the support of all the Arab states like they did before, you know, using them as an issue. A lot of that, unfortunately, is because of really shitty leadership that they had, whether it's Hamas or whether it's like that corrupt Fatah leadership that just did not take good deals when they had the chance and did not understand the way the diplomacy works. So, unfortunately, they got screwed not only by just everything that they're blaming right now, but also by their own leaders, some of which were actually elected. So now you're in a situation where, okay, in the future, what's going to happen? Now, if they wanted to do the right thing, and the whole world's all about democracy, they would just come out all the time and have these mass nonviolent protests saying, give us the right to vote. Period. Just come out, give us the right to vote. That's something the entire world...
James is saying, what are you talking about? Gaza and the West Bank have their own autonomous democratic government. Yeah,
but James, you know that they're not. You know that that's their own autonomous democratic. Their airspace control, their borders are controlled.
Yeah, like because they vote in terrorists into power. That's part of...
Yeah, Gaza does that. There's no occupation in Gaza. There's no settlements in Gaza anymore. But the thing is that there's... insurgents, terrorists, like all of this, that's a whole different discussion that you don't want to get into right now, right? But I agree with Christopher Hitchens on this. I think that if you are, you know, if you have been occupied illegally,
I feel like you're putting too much, I try to see the blame on both sides, but I think you're too one-sided on this thing, because I do think, like, as many mistakes as the Israeli government has made, the Palestinian governments had a lot of opportunities many, many times to end all of this. And I would say 80% of the fault is on the fault of the government, the Palestinian side, the government, right? For all of this occupation. I mean, this whole occupation and all of this crap could have ended ages ago if the Palestinian governments were not so...
That's the point. That's exactly the point I'm trying to make. So I'm not 80%. Right. I'm actually right down the middle, 50-50. I even wrote an article about this, and I still have that...
No, not 50-50.
I'll tell you. Yeah. So this is like, you know, what you're saying. If they didn't have the crappy leadership, if they hadn't voted like Islamic, like jihadists into power, like Hamas, I mean, that they were democratically elected.
Right. They have many opportunities,
and I've
so
always
so many olive that. Branches sent to them that they say, "Nope, let's continue fighting. We like fighting."
Wait, Armin, let me finish what I'm saying. So there's you know, one thing that I wrote in that article was that, what do they think? Do they think if Israel decided, okay, we're going to give them the two state, we're going to make this deal, it's great, does that mean that they're not going to start like coming in and attacking Israel anyway? Of course it doesn't. That's why Israel keeps the occupation in check. It's tried to ease it up. It's tried to done. It removed all of the settlements from Gaza as one way, step by step, to see what happens. And next thing you know, Hamas comes into Gaza. So yeah, the Palestinians, absolutely, I agree with you. There's a lot of like terrible things they've done, right? But at the end of the day, okay, fine. You've got the occupation. Supposing the occupation's entirely on the Palestinians, Israel's occupied them, because if they don't, then, you know, big war is going to happen. What about the settlements? Why are they keeping on building settlements in the West Bank? Like, why do they keep on doing it? There's absolutely no rational, non-religious, no secular reason for that to happen. In the U.S., every Republican and Democratic government since Johnson, or actually even before that, have opposed it's a bipartisan issue. They've opposed it. It's been part of every deal.
We're getting a little bit off track. Susanna's suggestion.
Susanna said, I never got to finish the thing that it was related to.
Can you say it faster, because we're getting off track? But go
We keep on getting into the tangents. But okay, so what's, if they came out, and if they in the future, if they just came in and started having like a democratic, a nonviolent democratic thing, if they did this at any time, they'd have the entire world's sympathy and maybe something would happen. But right now, it seems like they're going to be permanently occupied without the Democratic vote, right? Yeah. So
that's mostly their own fault. Mm-hmm. Mostly their own fault.
No, it's hey, listen, if you haven't occupied
Let's move forward. Susanna is saying, have you all had an episode on your differences regarding Zionism before? Because that'd be really good. So let's move all of this. I think that's a great suggestion. And let's move all of that talk into that episode, okay?
Okay.
To come back on this topic, let's do this. James.
Armin, speculate for a moment what would have transpired regarding Iran if Hillary would have won in 2016.
I think, well, we will still have the deal, the nuclear deal. What do you think? I don't know. It's complicated. It's too complicated. It's too many factors that we will have the nuclear deal.
Yeah, you can't. First of all, you can't speculate because you don't know what's going to happen. Hillary was more hawkish than Trump is. Hillary was more sort of, she would have taken probably more action against some of these Islamic fundamentalist elements than Trump has overtly. She would be very wary of selling weapons.
She would have removed Assad by now. Would have been removed by now.
It would have been gone. Like, so it would have been different. Whether it would have been better, whether it would have been worse, I don't know. I think that this is a big deal, like the peace deal that happened. I think that it would have probably happened with Hillary there too. Because this is essentially, it's an economic deal. This is an economic deal. It's been brewing for a long time. James, as you were saying earlier, that this has been going on for a very long time. Netanyahu's been building these relationships with the Saudis. MBS is vulnerable because, you know, the whole oil thing is going. He's got his Vision 3000 trying to invite investment because he knows the world's not going to be dependent on oil. Yeah, you know, his economy, basic fundamentals are vulnerable. So all of those factors would have still been in play. And ultimately, it was going to be this. It was going to be an economic alliance, an axis between like the rich countries like Qatar, Israel, the UAE, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, like all of these people. And it was going to be that traditional, okay, we're going to go to war, Game of Thrones mentality that Iran has. And there was just no way that house was
going to because we're, we said we're going to do this for this episode. We're going to try to keep it to 1 hour, right? So because we're hitting close, I just want to mention two things on my notes that I before we one thing I was going to say is like, have you noticed that Saudi Arabia's tourism videos recently?
No.
They don't mention anything about the holy cities or anything Islamic.
Oh, because foreign tourists can't go there unless you're Muslim. They have enough
tourists. No, but I'm just like, it doesn't even have any religious symbolism in it.
No,
like, there's nothing. Saudi Arabia, which is supposed to be the, you know, the center of Islam, the founding country of Islam, founding place, not a country, it was a country, but like, and the holiest place for all Muslims in the world. If you look at the tourism videos coming out of it, it does, you look at it as like, this could have been a tourist video for something, a country that had nothing to do with Islam. Like the tourism has nothing to do with Islam. There's nothing Islamic about there. Like, so that is very interesting. Okay. So both. So that is very interesting. Okay. Another thing I wanted to mention is that when that deal happens, if that deal happens and when it happens between Israel and Saudi Arabia, I am so excited to just see the Muslim YouTuber reactions to that and review it, like do live streams after live stream after live stream.
That's what you're excited about?
Yes, I'm excited to see that.
Happens and you're excited about the YouTube reaction.
Yeah, I'm excited to have the Muslim content creators on YouTube to see their reaction to it and then me reacting to their reaction to the deal and do live streams on that. Like, I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be cool.
Yeah, that can be a lot of fun. All right, let's just do patron questions for another 5 minutes and let's see where it goes.
So wait, James is saying, James is working on securing a guest to have a discussion about Zionism. I don't know if he's talking
about
that would be amazing. Let's bring, thank you, James.
I don't know if it was you who messaged me or somebody else who messaged me about there was somebody to talk to, but they never actually reached out to me. So if you could remind them if it was you. Otherwise, I would love to talk about this because everybody has different definitions of what Zionism is, specifically Jews. I think it came about after Seth Rogen said that thing And he got into trouble. I think it came about after that, but would love to talk about it. You know, I'm also really interested in the genetics of it. So I think we might have, I'll see if I can get Razib Khan back on to talk about how, you know, like how the Arabs in that region and the Jews in that region essentially genetically have virtually no differences. Like they all seem to be descended.
Yeah, James is saying it was me.
Yeah, it was. So excellent. Yeah, I know he's a very busy guy. If you could find somebody else, I would love to talk to them.
Yeah, send your guest suggestions to Ali Rizvi. He's the person that is in charge of our guests.
That's right. Okay.
No, here's a question. So
how would Hillary have removed Assad? Would the Russians have approved of it? Well, I don't think she was as susceptible to Russian influence as the guy now. So
I think she would brag about the fact that Russians are not approved.
Yeah. Putin hated her. So considering what was happened in the run-up to the 2016 election, if you remember, when she was talking about how Putin loves Trump, and Putin and Hillary had a lot of really, really public conflicts at the time that she was Secretary of State. So I think that I don't think that would have been as much of an impediment for her. I don't think they had a pee tape on her either. we're just speculating. You never know.
Don't kink shame people. You're laughing at people.
I know. No, but Hillary and Obama, these guys, they tend to be a little, they have been just historically a lot more hawkish. I mean, Bill Clinton was like that too. And so was she. You've always been. I mean,
they all had pee tapes?
Pee tapes. They were more hawkish about going into those conflicts.
So wait, so if they were more hawkish, wouldn't it have been worse than Trump then? If, like, imagine if Hillary was in power and she got the United States into war with Syria, and then potentially Iran wanted to get involved with that.
They couldn't have done the war thing. So one of the things that's happening, another aspect of this that we didn't really talk about, is the U.S. is drawing down troops from that region. This started happening during the Obama time because they just know it's useless. It's completely useless. They get into these long wars. It doesn't do anything. And then they eventually...
It's not useless. They make shitload of money off of these wars.
Not anymore. That changed with the Iraq war, right? They actually went into massive loss. They thought, oh, we're going to go there
for the oil. No, the people went into a massive... The taxpayer went to a massive loss. But the people that... The lobbyists and the, you know, military industry and the oil...
Armin, it's just universally, objectively, the Iraq war was not good for the U.S. The Afghanistan war was not good
for the U.S. people, but it was good for the U.S. military industry.
It wasn't. The military industrial complex is like this whole thing. Right now, the alliances are not about the military industrial complex. That's a sort of 1980 model. Right now, it's about global economic alliances. That's why the EU was formed in the 90s, right?
You're talking about two different things. Okay, more conflict sells more weapons, and these people are a powerful lobbying group. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is reality.
But it's not enough. It's not enough to suffer.
You could say that the people that lose money, here's what I think you're trying to say, okay? The people who are losing money
Let me say what I'm trying to say. I was in the middle of the sentence. Let me say what I'm trying to say.
You stopped, and now I'm talking, and now you interrupt. Okay, go on.
Oh, no, because I wanted you to finish, but then you said, let me tell you what you're trying to say. I'm asking you
if this is what you're trying to say. I'm not telling you what this is what I'm trying to say. I'm asking you, maybe a better take would be that the people who are losing a lot of money because of these wars, they're also powerful lobbying groups, and they also have influence. Maybe that's what you want to say.
Okay, so yeah, that's part of it. But what I really want to say, is that this whole the military, of course you're going to make them. You make more weapons, you're going to make money of it. But that cost, right, is not as profitable as what you lose in compromising these relations. So I want to
they're not the same entities.
I'll give you a quick example. This started in the 90s with the EU. So the EU, you remember there was a big war in the Yugoslavian country. There was Yugoslavia before, you know, Albania, Bosnia, all this conflict was happening. They found out this isn't going to help. They wanted an economic alliance for the entire EU. The euro currency was coming into place. And they went in. The US didn't do anything. NATO didn't go in and fix these wars before. But then they went and they got rid of these conflicts. The more we go in Ireland and all of these places, these conflicts are being traded now. The military conflicts are just not as profitable as having global economic alliances.
You're talking about the net. I'm hearing some echo. You're talking about the net effect. I'm talking about different entities have different motivations. For some entities, it's always just these conflicts are just profitable, right? Mm-hmm. But if you talk about the net effect, yeah, of course the net effect of war is negative, yes. Right? But of course it is. But the net effect sometimes is less influential on policies than the effect that it has on certain.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And though, if those certain groups have more influence on policies than the net effect has, then you might see policies being pushed towards more war, even though the net effect is negative, right?
But as you're saying, okay, so now we come to what you were saying, that I was saying about the lobbying, a lot of these powerful lobbies, it's they're finding that it's not really in their interest either.
Right.
And so so now you're in a situation where, like, so you're talking about Hillary and the Iran deal and everything. The Iran deal was actually done as a way to buy time until, because they knew that the leadership is getting old, the leadership is under attack from everything around it. They probably knew that these alliances are happening between Israel and Arabs and everything. There's going to be this big economic affront to Iran's sort of primitive thinking. And when that happens, they also knew the majority of the population is actually secular. They're moving in that direction. So they were buying time, and they're like, okay, after 10, 15 years, we think that this is going to change. And that was the thinking behind the Iran deal.
Right. So James is saying, I'm not suggesting that she would have needed Putin sign off. I'm referring to the military consequences. I don't think if United States brings all of its military, like not all of it, but its military might to Syria, I think Russia would back off. I don't think Russia will be ever interested into going into full-on, head-on-head confrontational war with the United States. If, as long as the United States is using its proxies or a little bit of its force here and there, I think Russia would also be interested in using its own military forces directly. But, I mean, Russia would not dare confront United States military might. Yeah. Directly. So I think if Hillary decided to just move into Syria and remove Assad or something like that, I'm not saying it would have gone that far. I don't know. But if it did, if she did do that, I don't think Russia would like, no, we're going to use our military directly to stop the United States. That would not happen.
I think, James, actually, I think you do have a really good point. I think we're going on this assumption that Hillary would have removed Assad. Like, sure, but she may actually not have, because I mean Obama had the chance to do that. Like, there was a chemical attack on fucking kids there,
yeah.
And we all saw videos of it, and he drew a red line that I'm going to draw this red line, and he never came through on it. In fact, what he did was, when Russia said it's okay, we're going to take all of Syria's chemical weapons, we're going to keep Assad in check, he's like, okay, done. Yeah, now I don't have to cross my red line. It's okay. Russia's taking care of it. That's how that conflict ended. So there was a hesitancy to removing Assad. And one of the reasons is that every time you remove an Arab dictator, guess what comes out in its place? Islamic fundamentalist parties, yeah, Muslim Brotherhood, everything. And you saw what happened to the Arab Spring.
Yeah, but they don't care. Hillary wouldn't care.
In Syria, it was ISIS. It was eventually ISIS. It became
more opportunity to intervene. Yay. Yeah, James. Okay, James is saying, yes, I don't think Syria would be Putin's hill to die on.
Yeah, I agree with
Neither
you.
Is Iran. Neither is Iran. Like again, all of these Iran seems like a significant ally of Russia right now to have for Russia, for it to be able to use its ties with Iran and Syria right now for Russia to have a say in what happens in the Middle East. But again, if Iran becomes too hot, Russia is going to be willing to drop it like a hot potato, they were never friends to begin with, right? Again, these are all just strategic alliances. It's not ideological at all. And, you know, Russia is not going to be willing to. Again, so this is why a lot of Iranian people are saying that, oh, you think Russia is defending us? Russia, like, they keep talking about the history of Russia and how it backstabbed Iran every time it was in their favor. So they were saying, like, we can't just bank on Russia's support for us to survive in the region. So that is also something. So what James is saying about Syria is also true about Iran. Anyways, yeah. We're over an hour, so let's end this here.
That's great, guys. Thank you very much. Actually, this was really good because I felt like because I knew we had an hour. I think I was really
yes,
it was focused. It was cool. I love it.
Yes. Yes. And yeah, I like how when you, this, like, usually live streams that is public, it's just like so chaotic and there's so much stuff coming at you. This is more like just with our patrons, and it's chill and it's relaxed. And we have like very intelligent discussions here with our patrons when we go.
Yeah. Around. And if you're listening to this on the public version, if you're listening to the local, fuck you.
Oh, yeah. No.
No, become a patron.
Become a patron. Yeah, become a patron so that you can actually talk to us while we're having these conversations. Link to our patron in the description. Yes.
Oh, we point down, right? That's what they do. We point it down.
Yes, but they can't see it because the public, when it's the public version of it, it's just audio anyway. So we're pointing down right now to the description. Like, guys, come on. Why are you listening to the audio version of this? Did you want to see our, you know, our
pointing down?
Yeah, no. Well, you know, us reacting to this, like you will see on our face how we feel about the things that we're talking about. Okay, so become a patron. Yeah, so become a patron so you can see that. Anyways.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's great if you're listening to this publicly, just the audio. You probably think we're both equally good looking. But
right. Yeah. Oh, let's just read just these comments. James is saying before we lose sight of the original topic, let's remember that peace is good. It's Rosh Hashanah. Is that how you say it? Rosh Hashanah. Yes, the new. Hey, shalom. Happy New Year, whatever. I don't know. Is that how you say it? The Jewish New Year. Have a great night today, everyone. Susanna saying, love you, boys. We love you too, Susanna. Family time. Matt is saying, LOL, my. Wow. Like and subscribe, etc. Yes, if you're listening to the public version of this, subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. Thank you.
Yeah.
And the secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give $1 or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.